the apostolic mission that the 12 received, of course, that comes from the Greek word, which means, sent out, usually implied, sent out with the authority of the sender, right? So they're sent out on a particular mission, and that mission is, in a limited sense, is to go out for a time and do the work that he himself, Jesus himself, was doing. So he was driving out demons, he was curing people, he was doing all of these acts of healing, and was gathering in these scattered tribes that had been just, again, cast to the four winds over the centuries, from the time of their unity under King David, which was about 1,000 years before Jesus. They, obviously had some varying success, but he sends them first to the house of Israel in particular, because God had laid his divine election upon them as his chosen people. And as we know, God does not just cast aside the things that he has determined to do for someone. So he wanted them first to hear the gospel, to hear the good news of salvation and the coming of the Messiah. And then afterward, after Christ's crucifixion and his resurrection, then the mission to the Gentiles begins. So as many as had been able to be gathered into the house of the church from amongst the people of Israel, then the doors were opened then for everybody else. We hear, Jesus' words: the harvest is abundant, but the laborers are few. So ask the master of the harvest to send out laborers for his harvest. He utters this, he tells this to the apostles as he sees the plight of the people in front of him. And I think when we ponder the realities of sin, I think so often we kind of come at it from this legalistic sort of standpoint, like, well, it's, there, sin is like, some, like, technically criminal actions that, as long as nobody finds out about it, it's not a big deal, or that God is this, this policeman who looks down on us from heaven and is like, well, I see what that one is doing. I'm going to get my hammer ready and I'm going to smash him, right? No. Christ looks upon those who are wounded by any kind of affliction, even self-infliction. And he looks upon them with great love and compassion because he sees their plight. And he wants them to have real life. A friend just told me via text yesterday that they were watching some kind of a show, a Catholic show, and somebody gave a definition of the gospel, or a summary of the gospel, in a few words, and their few words were, "Come out of hell." It's pretty accurate, right? God is beckoning us, come out of hell. Come out of this self-imposed prison that you put yourself in with sin. I want more for you. I want more for you. Unfortunately, though, there are, relatively few who give themselves over to the proclamation of this mission when we look at the sum total of humanity. And this is not a new thing. This is a very ancient reality. Those who are awakened to the realities of the spiritual life, and then have the zeal to try to go around and shake others into awareness, are relatively few. This is what our saint today really faced, St. Francis Xavier. He himself, probably by his own admission, was a little bit asleep himself. He was born in what we know today as Spain, in the Navarre region, kind of in the Basque region, and was kind of a highly placed nobleman. His father was some sort of a cabinet member for the king of that locale. Later on, when King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella ended up consolidating their rule there on the Iberian Peninsula, his family was basically out of a job because there was no longer a king, an independent king in that region. And so he went off to do some further studies. So he went to the University of Paris, and this is where he ran into, he had a roommate, and then they ran into St. Ignatius Loyola, who was also studying there and was formulating what would become, in short order, the Jesuit order. You know, the Jesuits were founded kind of as a dual mission of, their primary mission was trying to shore up the faith of Catholics, because this is in the immediate, I wouldn't even say the aftermath, it was in the immediate activity of the Protestant Reformation. And there were many, many people being pulled away from the faith. And so he really envisioned the Jesuits as a way of drawing Catholics back to their authentic Catholicism. And so he was kind of at the tip of the spear of what we call the Catholic Counter-Reformation, which was instead of being an attempt at reform by taking the toys and going home like Luther and Zwingli and Calvin and all these others did. No, the Catholic reformers were the ones that stayed in the bosom of the church and labored to make it what it ought to be, what it once was, and had fallen into disrepair, as it were. So at the time, Francis was recognized for his great abilities in the academic world, particularly in philosophy, and so he had gone from being a student there at the University of Paris to being a professor. At a young age, he was only in his 20s, I think, and he came across Ignatius, who persuaded him to consider the priestly life and consider life in this order that he was forming, which he eventually accepted. But, you know, he had a pretty comfortable position there in the University of Paris. He was widely and highly regarded for his own abilities, and, you know, he had a pretty comfortable life. But it was this strange figure of Ignatius that kind of shook him out of that. And so he consented to being part of this order and was really one of the co-founders of it, really, with Ignatius. Eventually, the Holy Father, looking at the state of the church throughout the world, noticed that India and the regions around the East Indies were... that were colonized by largely Portuguese people, traders and all those sorts of folks, was really in need of some pastoral care. While there was a little bit of a foundation of a church there, there were churches, there was even a bishop, there was some clergy, but for the most part, the Portuguese Catholics that were there were, well, let's just say they weren't great specimens of Catholicism. In fact, most of them were actually criminals or people on the run because they had done various illegal things. And so they figured, well, we'll just go to the other side of the world and that will no longer be a problem. And they continued to pretty much behave the way they had before. Though they were technically Catholics, they were not great examples of that faith. And that's what he found there whenever he went there. He was sent there by the Pope had requested Ignatius to send some missionaries there. And so he sent Francis, who went there first for a few years. After laboring there for a while, he met a Japanese merchantman. And eventually that merchantman converted. He was the first Japanese to convert to Catholicism. And then they went back to the Japanese islands, and that's where he spent the bulk of the rest of his life, of his, you know, dozen or so years of missionary work in the Far East. He spent most of it there and was opposed. He was opposed pretty much everywhere he went, let's just say, not least by his own Catholics, because he was so fervent and they had no desire to be, unfortunately. That was one of the biggest pains of his life, I think. But he went there and, you know, in various ways tried to insinuate himself into the culture there, which was, of course, starkly different in every single way to anything that he had ever experienced. Eventually managed to make some inroads, but then that first friendly rulers of the place kind of turned a suspicious eye toward Catholics. And you know, much of the history of the church in Japan has been one of kind of huddling underground and trying to faithfully pass on their faith. Eventually, though, he saw that there was even greater need on continental China. And so that was his great desire to go there. Unfortunately, he contracted a fever and died literally right on the doorstep of China. He was on a very small offshore island off the shore of China when he finally died at the age of 46 in 1552, I think it was. So he was buried and exhumed and, you know, reburied and multiple times. His remains are... at least the remains that I know of are his right arm that are in the, I believe it's in the Jesu, the mother house of the Jesuits. It might be in San Ignacio, which is also a Jesuit church there in Rome. But the reason his hand is there, and it's in the side altar to the right of the church as you're walking in, he baptized 500,000 people. So it's the hand that brought 500,000 people into the faith. But the guy was a hard charger. He was one of those rare individuals that went out to the abundant harvest, though the laborers were few. And he often, in fact, if you read the Office of Readings or some of his other letters, you know, he writes back to some of his friends back at the University of Paris, and he's pissed. He's pissed at them and everybody there in Paris. He's like, now that I see what I see and I see all the souls that are in such need, like, I just want to go there and scream, you know, and empty the place out and have them, you know, go to this place, you know, to go to these places and to show people the light of Jesus rather than just sitting there comfortably in the place that he used to sit comfortably, right, now that he had seen it. So, you know, and again, this will always be the case, I think, you know, barring some fantastically extraordinary grace of God from heaven, you know, that people will need these witnesses, you know, and as he lamented, you know, the witness of Catholics whenever he was there missioning in India was not great, you know, and that was the biggest obstacle. So, you know, the first thing is that we do not present obstacles to the faith ourselves, the obstacles to openness to the faith in other people. But then, you know, not to be afraid to be missioners of this treasure that we're given, come out of hell.